I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, well, welcome to spring. I mean, we always knew we were going to do a spring show, but what does that mean, really? I mean, the official astronomical start of spring was March 20th, but if you live in New Orleans, where I was last week for my beautiful friends Mike and Kathy's wedding, love you guys, spring was like a month ago. And if you're listening in Minnesota, spring might not be for another month or two. So maybe we thought a spring show should really be about rebirth, about seeing the sun and lightening up and growing. And that brought us to seeds. Dan Barber is a chef. One of his restaurants, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, was ranked the 11th best restaurant in the world. But right now, he's focused not on growing his restaurants, but growing new seeds. He's the co-founder of a new company called Row 7 that's all about breeding varieties of fruits and vegetables that we've never tasted before. Now, seed companies are not new. And if you're a gardener, you know, you're probably shredding all the seed catalogs you get every year for mulch, but what is new is that this is a seed company that brings in chefs to help direct breeders on what flavors to breed for in their vegetables. And the breeders know what will make these seeds viable on a large scale. This can actually change how we all eat. So hey, Chef, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, we talk a lot about knowing where your food comes from, right? And I think, you know, I actually credit you for a lot of that, the way we think about that as a chef, because you're a chef who has famously a restaurant on a farm, and you will bring products from that field directly to the table. You'll bring the dirt from the farm to the table, and you really help us reinforce this idea of where our food comes from. But I think for most of us, what that means is, oh, who's your farmer? Who's the person growing that food? And a lot of us, absolutely me included, don't take that one step further back into, well, where do the seeds that those farmers grow come from?
Right.
So who are the seed breeders? Like, where do they work? Who are these people? Where do they work?
Yeah. Well, this is a late inning revelation for me too. I wasn't asking those questions until one night about 9 years ago, a group of breeders from Cornell University came for dinner. And one of them at the table, I found him to be engaging and articulate, but he asked questions like he was thinking like a chef creating a recipe or something. So I was like, I want to talk more. This guy's name was Michael Mazurek, and he came in the kitchen at the end of the meal, and there was we got into a discussion, just like sort of banter. It was late at night, and there was a cook who was prepping a butternut squash in front of us for the next day, and Michael is a squash breeder. So I said, you know, if you're such a great squash breeder, why don't you figure out how to make a butternut squash taste good, you know, instead of like chefs doing these heroics of like roasting and caramelizing and adding, you know, maple syrup and gastriques and stuff. It's like, just create the thing and make it great. And what he said to me, you know, was probably what changed my appreciation for the work that breeders do, and also got me thinking about how to engage them more. He said, you know, in all my years of breeding, no one has ever asked me to select for flavor. And I thought that, I just thought that was nuts. Like, who is he talking to? And of course, in the years that followed, I learned exactly who these breeders are talking to, which is the large industrial food chain, which for the most part dictates how our seeds are selected and how they're going to be grown. You know, we think of the farming system as the template, but really it's the seed that's a template. It's the blueprint. And these breeders are creating the architecture for how we eat in the future. And these breeders are not talking to chefs like me or concerned, informed eaters like you. Even though we do represent a growing, dynamic cohort of well-educated and demanding. Yeah, these are people who are demanding like flavor in their food and want to know more about it. So we need to engage breeders was the end result of that conversation, because we need a seat at the table, and we don't have a seat at the table. Walmart has a seat at the table.
Right.
We don't have a seat at the table. So
right, and industrial producers,
to your point, they need things bred for shelf life. They need things bred for storability. They need things bred for a certain size so you can transport a certain way.
Yield's a big one.
Yeah.
You know, yields. These are all determining factors. And what you just listed, those are the top three. By definition, if you're selecting for those three things, you're selecting against flavor and nutrition, as it turns out. Flavor and nutrition, one of the great moments for me along the continuum of learning about this is the correspondence between flavor and nutrition. Like nutrient density and flavor, the same thing. Like flavonoids are flavor. And so you literally cannot have a jaw-droppingly delicious carrot without a nutrient-dense carrot. This is one of the same thing.
So you're starting this company to, as you put it, get chefs at the table with these breeders and help them think about the possibilities of flavor. But like, what does that mean? Like, you're not saying, could you grow me a watermelon that tastes like grape bubblegum?
That's not the point of the company, but if that is the North Star of a chef, I don't know. I mean, I guess my point is I don't want to shut out possibilities. The suite of possibilities is sort of endless, as breeders have taught me. It's like you need to ask, and they never get asked. What they get asked for are the three things we just talked about before, the shelf life, the uniformity, the yield. And so, you know, the food culture, as it were, is demanding uniformity. It's also demanding a seed that will grow similarly here in the Hudson Valley as it will in Southern California, as it will in Texas, as it will in Mexico, as it will in Canada, as it will in China. Because that's how seeds are developed these days, is that it's a one-size-fits-all approach. So what if we both, A, put flavor and nutrition at the top of the list of priorities, and also recognize that they're vastly different ecologies and geographies and cultural entanglements and histories that we should play into this breeding selection. And then all of a sudden, you start to see a very differentiated possibilities for the same seed as well as different seeds. And that's what's beautiful about seeds throughout history, is that they evolve through this beautiful correspondence between the ecological realities of where they were grown and the cultural realities, and they kind of evolved out of each other. And to that's what's so beautiful about chefs, it seems to me, and the way the food culture is headed, which is, you know, to advertise a sense of place and to tether it to history and to acknowledge some of the environmental conditions and to riff on that. And that's where great food is headed. To have a company that's responsive to that, I think, is both a good deal for eaters and also a good ecological deal, because it means you're growing seeds that are appropriate for place.
That's super interesting. So let's talk about these seeds. You have seven different seeds growing, obviously seven different plants. I was reading their descriptions and they sound
delicious.
Delicious, but in some ways like fantastic. In some ways I can't even imagine them. Like, you have a cucumber with fragrance that fills the room. A cucumber is like the most generic, you know, dumb vegetable. It's like you have your dumb salad, your dumb cucumber.
Yeah, right. And that's what we use in our restaurants, unfortunately, because we're sort of forced into that. But, you know, I did a very deep, delicious dive into the history of cucumbers. And what I learned is that cucumbers, first of all, do you know cucumber is poisonous? Like, the original cucumber is poisonous. So what we are eating... What we are eating is a weird genetic thing that happened to the cucumber, and all of a sudden there was a cucumber that arrived in the world that did not kill you when you ate it. There's some stories about what was the original, who ate that first cucumber, and it's animals, and people recognize that they were eating something that didn't kill them. Right. And from there, breeding of cucumber happened. And essentially, when you ate it, it was so bitter that it was unpalatable. What happened through the thousands of years of breeding is it became more and more sweet because you were selecting for that sweetness. And then the Dutch got it in their hands and it went totally to water and sugar and sweetness and really bland, which is what you're describing, which is what we live off today, are Dutch cucumbers that taste like nothing, especially the way they're grown in hothouses. And it's just a blank slate. But the original heirlooms, the older varieties, have quite a bit of bitterness to them. They don't kill you, but they tingle and they have a depth of flavor that's exciting. And so I all chefs are after that exciting flavor. We actually don't look for that kind of sweetness. We're looking for the depth of flavor, and that's right. What you get in these old varieties. So we took an old heirloom and mixed it with some of the modern varieties. And it turns out the fascinating thing for me of all of this was that there within that genetic traits that give you that bitterness. So again, it's a very complex cucumber. It's not what you're used to for a cucumber, mm-hmm. but it's really strikingly delicious and memorable. It also happens to have a kind of disease resistance in the field that most cucumbers don't have, especially this thing called powdery mildew, which is a terrible fungus for organic cucumber growers. So just actually by luck, more than a conscious plan, we were after the flavor, but it turns out that it's a very strong plant, and to grow it organically with these genetics is actually much easier. So the yield is good, the disease resistance is good, and the flavor and nutrition are off the charts. And that encapsulates what we're trying to do with the company.
We'll be back with more conversation with Dan Barber about the true flavor of the habanero and who all these delicious new plants are really for. And we'll have some inspiration for spring drinking from the author of The One Bottle Cocktail.
I sent bartenders to the grocery store, and I kind of had them tie their hands behind their backs. They couldn't use their back bar. They couldn't use the crazy collection of liqueurs, because every drink in this book has no vermouth, no bitters, no liqueurs, just a single spirit.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've been talking to the chef Dan Barber about his new thinking on the farm-to-table movement. He thinks we should be paying more attention to the seeds that farmers plant, and he's been working with seed breeders to develop fruits and vegetables with intense flavor that are also efficient enough for real big-scale commercial use. And while we're at it, why not add a few bells and whistles? You'll see what I mean. So I want to talk about another one of your seeds. Actually, I could sit here and talk about all of them. There are squashes that turn color when they're ripe, so you know when to pick them. Like, that's amazing. But I want to talk to you specifically about the habanada pepper. So this is...
Can I just interrupt you? I just want to underscore what you just said.
Yes.
This a squash that you pick when it's ripe. I mean, to stop on that one, we have a squash industry that picks 99.9% of its squash when it's unripe. And that's the problem with the adding the sugar and the maple syrup and caramelizing, because the squash is not ripe. And that, you know, it's like we just don't demand ripe squash.
We don't even think of ripeness
right.
of squash.
So the breeder said, I'm going to put a ripeness indicator. So it's going to be green, which indicates very quickly that it's not ripe. What squash now that's grown is it looks fully ripe, but inside it's completely green. And what he's reversed it and said, I'm going to select for the gene that makes you know when it's ripe. And therefore, it's like a vine-ripened tomato. You cannot pick it off the vine until it's ripe. And that assures a kind of flavor, complexity, and deliciousness and sweetness that one can only dream of. It's just that little trick.
Yeah.
But again, he turned to me and said, nobody's asked me to do that because the industry wants to pick it green.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to change the squash culture. But sorry, I interrupted you with that.
it's like a turkey timer. Like, bing, it's done.
kind
Pick
of.
Me.
It assures a kind of flavor that you wouldn't get. Yeah.
So let's talk about the habanada, the habanada pepper,
yeah.
which is an habanero mutation.
Well, it's selected. So this is the same breeder, Michael Mazurk, the guy came into my kitchen who's from Cornell. Brilliant breeder. And he loves peppers, but he can't stand heat.
Okay.
And so that's where it started. And the habanero for him is the most delicious, exquisite pepper in the world. But the breeding has gone towards the heat because Americans want heat, hot, blasting, overwhelming heat.
Right.
And he's like you are dissing what habanero really wants to be, which is floral and beautiful and lovely and sweet. And so he selected against the heat. And created this after 7 years, a pepper that he called habanada. So it is completely absent of heat.
Oh wow! But it has those incredibly like heady,
floral. Yeah. It tastes like fruit. A melon. I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible, and it just gets you to think about a pepper in a whole new way.
Yeah.
And you know, you look at it and you're thinking, "Heat. This is going to blow my mouth apart."
Yeah.
And also gets you to think about, well, why did peppers, what was it? How did peppers, I mean, chickens and fowl, they ate this hot stuff, but they didn't taste heat. And that's how peppers spread, is through fowl. They would eat, they didn't get affected by the heat, and then they'd poop out the seed in some other place. And that's how peppers spread throughout
Make
the world.
Fly, right?
Right. So it's almost like you, and then all of a sudden, every time I eat it, I'm thinking of like, you know, you have this power over the habanero that you never thought you could have. I think it's really stunning. So that's one of the seeds in the catalog.
That's amazing. So I want to talk about this word heirloom that you bring up.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of us, when we think of, heirloom seeds, heirloom tomatoes, obviously, like that's almost become like a meaningless marketing term.
Yeah,
but the idea of older seeds, the difference between what you're doing now and just getting older seeds is that those older seeds will have things like, they will produce fruit that may be delicious, but may have low yield, and you're crossing them to make them.
Yes, we're taking what we love about them, but making them just, appropriate to place. Because remember, heirlooms are coming from somewhere else. You know, you grow an heirloom here in the Hudson Valley, it wasn't bred in the Hudson Valley, it was bred in France or Italy or China or India, whatever the vegetable is. So just by first stroke, by putting it in the ground, you're making a compromise. It's a plant that was bred somewhere else. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to fail, and it doesn't mean that it won't be delicious. It just means that it could be so much more delicious and so much more productive if you select it for its particular environment. So that's what we're doing.
With the ecosystem.
Yeah, yeah. And make it viable, not just for me and my white tablecloth cathedral of a restaurant. Because that's the other problem with this, is that these tastes and these flavors that I am so excited about should not be in the
realm of the $300 tasting menu.
Yeah, why? But this makes, we tend to think that it's either that or Monsanto maniacs on the other side. And it's that's crazy. Like actually we can democratize this and we can make this into very affordable, delicious, nutritious food if we ask breeders for it. And we have to ask. And we want chefs at the table because they curate the stuff every night and they should be a part of the conversation. Because the reason I love chefs so much, not just because I wear a white coat myself, but because we are ambassadors of flavor. And by virtue of being ambassadors of flavor, we are ambassadors of nutrition. And one and the same thing, remember that. So that is a key component to this. And if you add in the regionalism, the possibility for expression of place, you get a very dynamic and interesting food culture for the future. But it has to start with seeds.
Right. All right, well, here's to the future, Chef.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Dan Barber is the chef of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and his latest venture is the Row 7 Seed Company. So the weather's warming, and the sun is staying out longer, so you might be in the mood for some lighter drinking. Maggie Hoffman's written a terrific new cocktail book that's all about forgetting those, you know, those complex, like, four liquor potions that bartenders are so into now, and it's full of ideas for just grabbing that one bottle of whatever you have, getting some fruit or herbs or, you know, stuff that's ready in your fridge, and mixing up something that's fresh and delicious and didn't cost you a car payment to stock up for. Our friend Shauna Seaver talked with Maggie about her book and some of her favorite spring drinks from it.
Hi, Maggie. Thanks so much for talking with us.
I'm so happy to be here.
Now, I love a craft cocktail at a beautiful bar, but I do consider myself a bit of a cheap date when it comes to actually stocking my own liquor cabinet at home because it seems daunting and kind of expensive, which is why I fell in love with your book. So tell us about the idea behind One Bottle Cocktail.
Well, you know, I think you're right that when you go to a bar, you're there for the whole show. And bartenders today are really excited about all the new things they can get. And there's a bunch of cool importers bringing in historical and rare cocktail ingredients. And they can make you something so fantastic. And then they can make it again for 100 more people. So it's worth it for them to have those ingredients. But, you know, there's never been a time where what you can get in a bar has been further from what you actually want to make at home. You also don't want to test out a drink that's going to cost you $75 to make. If you buy a bottle of green chartreuse, it's going to run you $35, and that vermouth is another $15, and plus your spirit. And pretty soon, a three-ingredient cocktail costs you $75. So the idea is to take that expense out, which means you can have a little more fun and experiment a little more. And so I sent bartenders to the grocery store, and I kind of had them tie their hands behind their backs. They couldn't use their back bar. They couldn't use the crazy collection of liqueurs, because every drink in this book has no vermouth, no bitters, no liqueurs, just a single spirit. And these bartenders, I worked with about 70 bartenders to put these together. These bartenders tried to think about how they could add the flavors, the savory flavors, the bitter flavors, all the flavors that can team up to make a balanced drink from a spirit or liqueur or bitters, how to create those using just the pantry and just fresh ingredients you'd get at the grocery store. So they use herbs like tarragon instead of using an herbal liqueur, and they use oolong tea and jasmine tea and a lot of these things that you would use with food, marmalade and fig preserves. And these things can add complex flavor and even the bitterness you really need to balance a cocktail.
But the main ingredient of all of these cocktails is just one spirit at a time, right? So you've, the chapter breakdown is one spirit per chapter.
Right. So you have, say, 10 gin drinks. And then at the back of the gin chapter, when you've made all of those drinks, you made the one with figs and you've made the one with lemongrass and maybe you've made the one with cucumbers and rose water. And there's one that uses coconut and rice milk. Some really cool things. When you get to the back, there's a section called bonus drinks, which has more gin drinks. And the way this happened is that each of these drinks has a single spirit. So it was designed for tequila, or it was designed for vodka, or designed for bourbon. And as the bartenders were sending these recipes to me, they'd say, well, this is a tequila drink, but you might also try it with gin, because tequila has an herbal character that isn't actually that different in some ways to gin. Maybe they're cousins. Or they'd say, this is a bourbon drink, but maybe try it with rum. And so I tested all of the drinks again using all different spirits, and the ones that really worked are listed in that back section.
Now, it sounds like you got quite a few enthusiastic responses from bartenders, but I'm curious if there were any bartenders that rejected this idea of only using one spirit in a cocktail.
Completely. I had a few angry messages saying, you know, these aren't cocktails. The traditional definition of a cocktail is that you have your spirit, say it's rye whiskey, and you have a sweetener, could be a sugar cube, and you have bitters. And sometimes you'd have a liqueur to sweeten it. But at the very least, you're supposed to have this sweetener and bitters. And so they said, these aren't cocktails. I don't work this way. But I think I want to welcome people to expand the definition of cocktails and say, yes, you have your spirit, and then you have something that's bitter. And so the clever thing that the bartenders in this book did is come up with different solutions. So one of the drinks you shake with a few grapefruit peels, a few grapefruit twists. And the oil from the outside of the grapefruit does that bitter thing and cuts the sweetness of the drink. So it's quite tart and bitter and really refreshing. There's another bartender who made a syrup with radicchio, which just blew my mind. But of course, radicchio has this sort of sweet vegetal flavor and also some bitterness. And he added rosemary and grapefruit peel as well. And you end up almost with something like the Italian liqueur Cynar, which is very popular. It's very delicious. I love it. But when you can't use that, you can DIY. And anyone who's comfortable in the kitchen, anyone who's comfortable making tea can make these things.
And it's nice to have a cocktail book that encourages you to play, I think, in a way that other cocktail books don't. So let me ask you this. Even if my home bar isn't very stocked, I usually have, say, a bottle of vodka rattling around in the freezer. What kind of drink should I be making this spring with that vodka that I already have?
Oh, lots of fun things. You know, I think we still have really good citrus. And one of my favorites is from Sarah Rosner, who's in Washington, D.C. And she uses tangerine juice or mandarin orange juice and lemon together with turmeric and club soda. And that with a little honey and vodka is really delicious. And if you have gin instead of vodka, you can do that. Another one that I love is a sort of light take on the Bloody Mary that is from Matthew McKinley Campbell, who's out here in the Bay Area. And what he has you do is take cherry tomatoes, which, you know, are pretty decent year-round, and you put them in the blender with fresh pineapple and a little bit of the adobo sauce from a can of chipotles and some fresh cilantro and lime juice and a little agave, a pinch of salt. And you blend all these things together in your blender until they're smooth. And then you strain it and you have this really light, spicy, fruity, slightly savory basically Bloody Mary mix. And what's fun about this is you don't throw away the solids in your strainer after you've strained it. You take the liquid, put it in your fridge, you're going to mix it half and half with vodka. It's also really good with reposado tequila. But you take the solids and put them in a bowl, and what you have with that cilantro and the pineapple and the cherry tomatoes is a really nice salsa, which you can serve on the side. So that kind of pulls double duty.
Oh, that's really fun. I'm going to be trying that tonight, probably. Well, thank you so much, Maggie. It was a pleasure talking to you. And cheers.
Cheers.
Maggie Hoffman is the author of The One Bottle Cocktail. Shauna Seaver's latest book is called Real Sweet. And Maggie left us with a whole clutch of recipes. You can find her Gin Rocket, The Desert Sunset, and this little strawberry yogurt and gin guy called The Slippery When Wet. And you can find those at splendidtable.org. All right, let's talk, you and me. You can always call us, 1-800-537-5252. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can email us, contact@splendidtable.org. All right, we have Tien on the line from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Tien, how are you?
Hi, Francis. I am doing fantastic.
What do you want to talk about?
So I am a doctoral student, just a lowly grad assistant right now. And I cook a lot at home and have been really inspired not only by the show but also just by people like Julia Child, Martha Stewart, people who have really kind of created a culture of learning about food along with so many other chefs. And I wanted to know what the most impactful dishes were that made you kind of look at food completely differently. Like my partner's Filipino. And the moment that I had dinuguan for the first time, which is pig's blood, not something that we would traditionally eat. My family is Spanish and then some Korean in the mix. And, you know, that's not something that would traditionally be eaten by us. And it was so good. And then also along the same token, as somebody like myself who's a grad student with a limited amount of time, what ways you might apply those dishes for someone in my situation.
Yeah, well, okay. So dishes I've made early on in my cooking life, like I remember making mac and cheese when I was a kid, and you know, mac and cheese is not a thing that we really ate a lot of in my family, but I just wanted it, and like it was probably something I first had at school, and I was like, well, it's macaroni and it's cheese, right? So I just boiled macaroni and literally went and took American cheese slices and just stirred them in, and I remember making it for my brother after he got home from school, because I was so proud of myself for having made this thing that, you know, had a name. But maybe that's not exactly what you're talking about.
No, that is exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah.
And I remember when I was in college and living, you know, out of the dorm and in an apartment and being like, okay, now I guess I need to cook for myself. Just remembering seeing, you know, people in my family cooking and just trying to like reverse engineer stuff. And I remember making a lot of fried rice. I would take out the rice cooker and I would just make rice and keep in the fridge. And when I was hungry, I would get this little nonstick wok I had hot with oil. And I just remembered you'd have to put ginger and garlic and chopped up scallion in the oil. We called it exploding it in the oil,
right?
Although it was never actually that violent. And then we threw in the rice. And then from there, it was kind of like all bets are off. Like whatever else I put in was going to be dinner that day. You know, whatever I had lying around, if it was like bits of ham or bits of sausage or vegetables I had chopped up. And I remember like for a while, I would make fried rice with fish sauce because I'd sort of discovered fish sauce from like, oh my God, this flavor is amazing. So it'd be like fried rice with fish sauce all day long. And then I discovered this stuff called ketchup manis, which is like a dark, sweet soy sauce. So I would cook the fried rice and sprinkle some of that in. It was like really thick and syrupy and molassesy. And so that would balance with the fish sauce to make this very sweet, savory flavor. Pretty much I went down to the Asian market and every like new condiment I found, like that became the base flavor of my next batch of fried rice. So,
got it.
I mean, I don't know. I can still taste those now in my memory. Like I haven't made fried rice that way in a really long time, but that was kind of how I cooked for myself for like a year.
I never thought about the idea of taking just kind of a staple food that you're used to eating and then incorporating ingredients that you might be unfamiliar with just to kind of get a baseline on how to use them in other dishes. That's fantastic.
Yeah, like I had my basic fried rice the way I made it. I don't know. I don't think it's like a proper technique. But yeah, I would just switch out with a different condiment and let that be the defining flavor of that dish that day. So that way I could have like, if I had eight different condiments, I could have eight different days worth of meals.
Right. That's perfect. I mean, I cook a lot. My dad is Cuban and is the one that has kind of Korean in the mix. So there's kind of the staple foods from both of those cultures. And I never thought about kind of exploring other cultures' condiments and flavors in bringing them into stuff I'm already so familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, check it out. Try it. I mean, if you like fried rice, obviously you can do that. Or if there's another sort of staple-y, starchy kind of carb thing that you just love that just feels comforting to you. If I were to redo this experiment now, I mean, certainly I can keep doing it because there are a trillion condiments you find from a trillion different Asian cuisines. But I could also imagine, say, doing that with a romesco sauce, right? I can imagine doing that with sofrito. You know, and changing up the flavors that way, because fried rice, to me, kind of no matter what, feels comforting and tastes delicious. So, Yeah, have fun with that.
Oh, my God. You are the best. You just made my entire day. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much for the call. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you. Same to you, Francis.
Take care, Tian.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Coming up,
everybody's been charring vegetables. But as it turns out, you have these really delicate, beautiful, fresh spring vegetables that you can braise, which produces this beautifully bright green or, with radishes, bright pink, beautiful fresh colors.
Try babying your baby vegetables. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. And we're back to keep talking to all y'all. Remember, we love it when you call us, 1-800-537-5252, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So we have a question from Twitter. It's from Kumari Devarajan. I hope I pronounced that correctly, Kumari. And Kumari says, recently inherited an enormous bag of cardamom. Don't ask how, which, of course, now all I want to know is how. And how do I make chai from it? What else can I do with it? Okay, so cardamom is a beautiful, beautiful spice. I'm assuming you mean you got whole pods. And they're like these little sort of, you know, about the size of your thumbnail or your fingernail kind of pod. And if you crack them open, they can come green or black. They're actually quite different, but I'm assuming you mean green because that's sort of more common. And if you crack the pod open, it has these little black seeds that fall out of it. And the aroma and the flavor of cardamom is so floral and it's so sweet. It's a gorgeous flavor. It's like super intoxicating, but it can be pretty overwhelming. So I would say to use it pretty judiciously until you kind of get a feel for how much you like. Often you can just drop the whole pod in to something and steep it. And it'll get some of that flavor out. And the fact that it's kind of still stuck in the pod and it's not going to, you know, the seeds won't necessarily come out of it. And you're not breaking the seeds. You're not releasing all the oils in the seeds. That'll kind of help you keep the flavor a little bit mitigated. So it's not just like full bore. And that's how I usually make chai with it. I would heat milk. And I was taught this method by a friend. I don't know if it's, and this is the way her family does it. I don't know if this is like, you know, the proper way or whatever, but you actually mix half and half milk and water, put the amount of tea that you want into a little pot, and you actually cook the tea in the milk. The tea extracts pretty strong, so you don't have to use that much tea because you're cooking it for a long time, and it does bring out some of the bitterness, but in a way that's sort of nice, I think. You sugar it, and then you just drop in a few spices, maybe some black peppercorns, a pod or two of cardamom, you know, depending on how much you're making. That I would do that for maybe like 2 cups, 3 cups. Maybe I'd do a pod or a pod or two. What did I mention? I mentioned black pepper, cardamom, and maybe a cinnamon, maybe a little bit of cinnamon. I don't want you to go too strong on that, and maybe a clove or two. Definitely some sliced ginger. And just kind of like let them all steep and simmer together for like 5 or 10 minutes. strain it out, and that's a really, really beautiful cup of masala chai. Always feel free to call us at 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So wherever you live, whenever spring happens for you, you probably want to celebrate the first tender vegetables that arrive in your market or garden. But what do you do with them? Our boss Sally Swift talked with America's Test Kitchen's Ashley Moore on what they've been playing with in the Test Kitchen.
Hey, Ashley, good to have you here.
Oh, it's so great to be here, Sally. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you know, we have been charring vegetables over the last couple years, which have been great and have changed the career of broccoli and cauliflower. But as spring arrives, and all these beautiful tender things are coming to market, radishes and asparagus and chives, I'm wondering if you have another approach that we can try.
Oh, we absolutely do, and it's a surprising one. It's braising spring vegetables.
Really?
Yes. All winter long, we've been cooking these stews and having these tougher cuts of meat, and you don't think of braising vegetables.
So tell me, what does braising do for vegetables?
Well, it cooks it gently. It cooks it low and slow, and it helps to tenderize these beautiful, delicate vegetables and cook them evenly and at the same rate.
So give me an idea for something I can try.
Okay, so you have to try this. This is our recipe for braised spring vegetables. And essentially what you're doing is you're making a really flavorful braising liquid. So ours, for instance, has a good amount of extra virgin olive oil and some shallots and red pepper flakes and thyme sprigs. And there's orange zest and lemon zest in there. So already you're getting the idea that it's a super floral, beautiful braising liquid, a broth, if you will. And then what you do is you stagger the cooking. You stagger the vegetables because they're delicate, and some of them are more hardy, but they all are relatively delicate and they cook at different rates. So for this, we have a combination of asparagus, radishes, and peas. Obviously, peas are super delicate, and we know that asparagus is a little bit more hardy, but then you have radishes, and those are the hardier of the three. So we're gonna start and cook those first. So those cook for a few minutes until really nice and tender, and you can pierce them with a tip of a paring knife. And then in the Dutch oven, you add some asparagus, and the asparagus is cut into smaller pieces. You're not going to be dealing with big, long asparagus spears here.
So you're essentially cutting them the same size as the radishes.
Exactly. They're a little bit bigger, but you want everything to be cooking uniformly, cooking at the same rate. And then the recipe finishes by adding some frozen peas. And just off heat, you let the peas sit in that covered Dutch oven with all the rest of the vegetables, and they gently cook just for a few minutes until heated through. And then that's it. The recipe is done. But before you eat, you're going to season it with some salt and pepper and stir in a good amount of chopped fresh tarragon just to bring in that extra floral spring, bright, fresh flavor.
I can just smell that with the orange zest and the lemon zest. It sounds
beautiful. It's so good.
You know, people don't often eat cooked radishes, and they are delicious.
They absolutely are.
And beautiful in this recipe, I bet.
Yes, they are a gorgeous fuchsia pink color. They're just breathtaking.
How perfect. So the other spring vegetable that I think a lot of people work with this time of year are artichokes. And you know, I think everyone braises them or steams them. Do you have another approach?
We roast artichokes.
Huh, really? Tell me how you do that.
Okay, so I mean, think about it this way. When you steam or when you boil artichokes, a lot of that flavor is in the water as opposed to in the artichoke. And you're going to pour that water down the drain. So instead, roasting artichokes brings out all of that flavor and actually keeps it in the artichoke. So the way you do it is you heat your oven to 475 degrees. So that's pretty hot.
That's blasting.
Oh yeah, blasting. So you're going to take trimmed artichokes that you've halved, and you're going to cook them for about 25 to 30 minutes until they're super tender. And the best thing about artichokes is that you've got a ton of different types of textures. You've got the stem, which gets super soft and buttery. You've got the heart, which is just the most amazing thing in the world. And then you've got those leaves that, oh my goodness, the flesh of those leaves that you get to drag your teeth along and scrape them into your mouth. There's just nothing better than a well-cooked artichoke.
That just sounds great. I never would have roasted them. That's a great idea. And they get crusty and brown then, too, at that temperature.
Yeah, you get that beautiful chestnut brown color from the roasting and the caramelization of everything. It's just such a great way to cook them.
All right, we're braising and then blasting. It's the perfect braising spring approach. Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you.
Ashley Moore is an associate editor at Cook's Country Magazine. You can find that recipe for braised spring vegetables at splendidtable.org. And look, I mean, I definitely don't want to mess with ATK's recipe, but if you're in a part of the country where asparagus is long gone, in my head, I can just taste that same dish made with zucchini instead of the asparagus, and I think it'd be terrific. So check it out. Well, we started this hour talking about the possibilities of creative seed breeding, and we'll finish it with a story about the hope that seeds may bring. 6 months ago, Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. It's the worst natural disaster in the island's history, and the aftermath is one of the worst humanitarian disasters in American history. Nearly the entire island was without power or safe drinking water for months, and even now, half a year later, there's still 250,000 people without power. The storm basically destroyed the little local agriculture that was there. So, silver linings are hard to come by in a situation like this, but there are some people who hope that an airlifted supply of seeds might give rise to a new generation of Puerto Rican farmers and gardeners. Daniela Cheslow has the story.
I drive through the mountains of Puerto Rico with agronomist Viviana Medina. A few months after Hurricane Maria, it's striking to see leafy green trees towering above us. That foliage is all newly grown since the storm. We drive through a village.
We just passed a man walking by who was wearing a t-shirt that read, "On the pizza diet."
Yeah, a lot of us have been on the pizza diet after Maria.
The pizza diet because there was almost nothing else to eat for the first weeks after the storm. The hurricane knocked out electricity and refrigerators didn't work. Gas for cooking was scarce. Brick ovens were a hot commodity.
For pizza, you just need some yeast, some flour, and some water, and, you know, you're good to go.
In the first days and weeks after Hurricane Maria, the ports in Puerto Rico were closed and then backed up. And that is the primary source of food on this island. It's been that way for decades. In the 1940s, the territory industrialized as companies from the mainland U.S. set up factories here.
I think we've been very Americanized in Puerto Rico.
Viviana grew up here. When she decided to study agronomy at the University of California, Davis, there were some raised eyebrows.
My mom friends and some family members would be like, "Why don't you become a doctor? Why don't you become a lawyer? You've gotten such a great education. Like, why that?"
In recent years, Puerto Rico suffered through a recession. In these tough times, a tiny back-to-the-land movement took root. Some farmers who grew coffee and chocolate for export planted vegetables for the local market. A few farm-to-table restaurants opened in San Juan. Growers experimented with rice and beans, the staples of the island. The storm ripped up nearly all that local agriculture.
My aunt was saying, like, she felt like it was like an atomic bomb. You know, everything was wiped out. There was not even a leaf on a tree. It was pretty devastating.
Nuclear-scale devastation demanded a nuclear response, an airlift. Viviana and friends from UC Davis collected 10,000 pounds of vegetable seeds, mostly from a Connecticut seed company, and orchestrated their flight to San Juan. The plan is to get those seeds to farmers and gardeners across the island.
Pepsi. Para aquí. 429.
We arrive in the village of Orocovis and wait at a Burger King. Here we meet David Matos. He's one of the 70 agricultural extension workers distributing the donated seeds with the University of Puerto Rico. We get in his car. David, can't you just buy seeds in a store?
Tan carísimas.
They're very expensive, he says. They're very expensive.
Allá en Santa Isabel, que tienen la tienda de store.
He said that there's few stores and they're on the other side of the island by the south.
That's a long drive for people living in an old age home. Our first stop, we pull into a parking lot that's also a dump site for rusted fridges, crumpled zinc roofs, and torn mattresses. They were all destroyed in the storm. David and Viviana take two paper bags out of the car.
Cilantro, lettuce, cucumber.
And those are the flowers.
And flowers.
They walk into a cafeteria where 36 seniors eat lunch. David tells the old timers to remember the gardening lesson he gave them. Make good use of these seeds. One woman interrupts David to hug him. Another one claps. It's Olga Maria Rivera Cartagena. She's 74. She says she can't find fresh vegetables in Orocovis, but she'll plant these seeds. Next stop is a school. Dalma Cartagena meets us in a field where she teaches kids to grow their own food.
Hola.
She wears her long gray hair in a braid. A wide-brimmed hat hangs on her back. The hurricane splintered her greenhouse and ripped branches off the trees that arch above us like the walls of a cathedral. And I can't see this, but Dalma says the hurricane lifted a whole section of earth out of the ground, almost like a slice of sheet cake. That's where she started replanting.
Here, I plant vegetables because they are ready in a short time. It only takes 35 days to have lettuce. It only takes 60 days to have beans.
On our way out, we stop for gas, and David has to borrow cash from Viviana because there's still no electricity for the credit card machine. Nearby, workers hammer blue tarps on top of leaking roofs. People do their laundry outside in a row of white washing machines connected to a generator. I wonder about the impact of vegetables compared to pressing needs like power and housing. I put the question to the head of the largest farm credit bureau in Puerto Rico, Ricardo Fernandez. He told me the hurricane damaged half the island's greenhouses, dairies, and barns, and the costs of farming have more than doubled. Short-term crops, like vegetables, are the easiest product to bring back.
Don't worry, be happy.
We pull up to a house. About a dozen retirees eat lunch outside.
Rice?
Sure, thank you.
Beans?
De aquí mismo.
De aquí mismo, from right here, in the garden. Gloria Peña lives here, and she planted those beans just after the storm. She passes me a bottle.
That's pitorro, that's moonshine.
Homemade moonshine. Gloria and her husband Jose serve it at their gardening club. They meet once a week.
And we do the gardens in school, houses, people that wants to build their own garden.
They'll plant those donated seeds in the gardens. Jose and Gloria were born in Puerto Rico. They lived in Pennsylvania for about 30 years.
I did work in a railroad company, then I worked in a paper mill, then I bought a grocery store.
He and Gloria worked hard, often every day of the week. They had three kids together. And about 8 years ago, when the kids went to college, Jose and Gloria sold the business and moved back to the island.
It was gorgeous to live here, you know. It was beautiful. But now after Maria, it's a different story.
Everything looked so burned, you know, the trees were down. And it was just a weird feeling, like you were in the desert all alone, you know, with nobody else.
Hurricane Maria knocked out their electricity. It's still out. Jose and Gloria's garden was destroyed. Only yams and celery roots survived, and they ate those. Their kids couldn't reach them for 8 days. And when they did, they begged them to do what hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans have done since the storm, move to the mainland. You gonna do it?
Yeah.
No.
No. No, right now, no.
Why not?
We have a lot of fun here. We grew up here. We belong here.
I don't want the cold anymore.
But the hurricane did make them think about the way they live in Puerto Rico. Gloria shows me the garden, newly planted on a windy hill.
We have ginger over there, right on the side of the greenhouse. And then here there's tomatoes. I think that's an avocado tree there.
That little sapling?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The seniors celebrate a birthday. They sing and laugh. Old friends who started growing vegetables together as a hobby. Now it's also an insurance policy.
Daniela Cheslow is a multimedia journalist. Man, I have to say, incredible to hear that story and to hear the resilience and hope and humor in the voices of the people who are working so hard to rebuild their lives. And I hope you find some inspiration in those voices too. So that's our show for the week, but if I may, I'd love to encourage you to find an organization you admire doing good work in Puerto Rico and find a way to support them if you can. Thank you so much for listening. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thanks to everyone who's contributed and made this show possible. We literally couldn't do it without you. And to help support our show, just head to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, look around. There are tons of recipes, info on all of our guests, a whole bunch of videos, and you can sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it'll make your Monday to Friday cooking a little easier. And look for our podcast. We have a brand new one called Splendid Table Selects, where we share the interviews that have inspired us, taught us something new, or just made us better cooks. Subscribe and leave us a review. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our brand new assistant producer. Everyone be nice. Say hi, Erica. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.